Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a new memoir, Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown tells the world that he was sexually molested as a boy, that he kept it a secret out of fear and shame for decades. It's a brave admission, and it brings to light an issue that's far more common than it is spoken of, male sexual abuse. My guests today say that one in six males is sexually exploited or assaulted before adulthood. It's bigger than our stereotypes, they say, and too big to ignore. This hour On Point, male sexual abuse and its consequences. You can join the conversation. Did you know that male sexual abuse was so common? Do you give it the same weight as the abuse of young women, girls? Is Scott Brown's story some version of your own? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On 60 Minutes last night, CBS, Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown told host Leslie Stahl that he kept his history of sexual abuse secret for a long time out of fear and shame.
He said, if you tell anybody, you know, I'll kill you. You know, I will make sure that no one believes you. And that's the biggest thing. When people find people like me at that young, vulnerable age who are basically lost, the thing that they have over you is they make you believe that no one will believe you. You know, you can't.
So you never reported it?
No. My mom will read about it for the first time. My wife is read about it. No one. I haven't told anybody. That's what happens when you're a victim. You're embarrassed. You're hurt.
That's what happens when you're a victim. The whole story out in Senator Brown's new memoir, Against All Odds, out today. Joining me now from Columbus, Ohio, is Howard Fradkin, psychologist who's worked with over 1,000 male sexual abuse survivors. Howard Fradkin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And with me in the studio is Mikkel Rau, trauma therapist from Brookline, Massachusetts. She and Howard, both affiliated with the group Male Survivor, a nonprofit focused on confronting the sexual victimization of boys and men. She's also treated many. Mikkel Rau, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Howard, let me come first to you and Scott Brown's story. How typical, how atypical. What are you hearing when you hear this very prominent, right there on 60 Minutes, telling of the story of childhood sexual abuse?
Well, Scott Brown certainly represents the amount of courage that I've seen with many, many male survivors who are willing to speak the truth about the story of their abuse. So I really honor that he had the courage to speak up. It's very typical. He's about the right age that men oftentimes report, the average age that men are abused, about age 9 or 10. So that's pretty normal. What's abnormal is that Scott, the shame that he felt is very normal, the embarrassment, mm-hmm. the not talking about it for decades, very normal because of all that embarrassment and because men are not supposed to be victims. They're supposed to be the ones in control.
Mikkel, there are two, he tells of two instances here, maybe more times than that, but one at a camp, a summer camp, he's 10 years old and a camp counselor, is aggressive in sexual abuse there and makes the threats that we heard him just talking about. Another time when an older boy has him in the woods with a knife and threatening him, demanding oral sex, he bashes him in the head and runs away. These are kinds of things that men do not talk about from their childhoods often. And the numbers that you and Howard put on the table as representing the actual instance or frequency of abuse are kind of startling.
I think that often, especially men, tend to minimize what's happened to them. For instance, Senator Brown talked about that his abuse wasn't consummated. It doesn't matter whether it was consummated or not. Sexual abuse is an exploitation of someone's body, and combined with trauma, with physical abuse and threats, it tends to shut someone down, maybe for decades, 41 years in Scott Brown's case.
Here's Scott Brown talking about exactly that last night. He was fairly explicit, but then a little euphemistic here. We're left to wonder, but he's more out there than most men overwhelmingly. Here he is again talking with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes.
Fortunately, nothing was ever fully consummated, so to speak, but it was certainly back then very traumatic.
Well, you say it wasn't consummated, but you knew.
Oh, I knew.
He touched you.
Yeah, he touched me, and I knew that.
And you he made you touch him.
Yeah.
And then you thought you had escaped, and he came for you again.
Yeah.
More than once.
As predators do.
As predators do. Howard Fradkin, what about the frequency of this kind of thing happening? You've got these numbers, 1 in 6, 1 in 4. Where would Scott Brown, do you call this, you know, where does he fall in your sort of definition of things that happen? And what's the frequency of those things in our society as far as you know?
Well, it's accurate that the 1 in 6 men are sexually abused before the age of 16. And actually, that's about over 18,959,000, according to the 1in6.org folks who just were on last night as well. Mm-hmm. And if you include people who have been covertly abused, those are people who may have witnessed sexual abuse of someone else, people whose parents were inappropriate with them, such as parents who sleep with their children, parents who make sexual comments about a boy's genitals, it really goes up to 1 in 4, which is a huge number. That's the same number as the statistic typically used for women who are abused.
Can we define our terms a little bit so we know what you're talking about when you say 1 in 6 and 1 in 4? You say sleep with their children, and I can imagine parents who were with their one-year-old and they climbed into the bed last night saying, wait a minute, that's not sexual abuse.
Right. I mean, parents who are sleeping with children who no longer need to be sleeping with their parents. So children who are 9, 10, 11, 12. I mean, I've heard stories of parents sleeping with children. And again, not just sleeping with them, but of course sleeping with them, touching them, holding them, hugging them, expecting their children to meet their emotional needs is an inappropriate and a kind of what we call covert sexual abuse.
Mikhail, what about the 1 in 6? Straight up sexual abuse before 16, what does that mean? What are the boundaries of that? That sounds so alarmingly high. I think people are going to want to know what you mean by that.
Sexual exploitation.
Is it an arm around? Is it the pat on the butt that people get really upset about these days at the soccer game? Is it something worse than that?
A lot of times it has to do with context, not just content. You can put your arm around someone. You might, you know, at a football game, you might
smack somebody on the way to the field.
But it is all about intent. And when a parent is involved with their child in a sexual way, it means that the child is meeting their sexual needs, the adult's sexual needs, not the child's need to be an innocent child.
Are there numbers on how the sexual abuse of males, young males, compares to that of young females?
Well, we think that 1 in 4 females is sexually abused. I think the understory here is that because of the fact that males are often they minimize what has happened to them. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of sexualized contexts that they have lived in. Mm-hmm. They've been exposed to porn often at a really young age. Sometimes they consider this initiation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes this is the way that they're exposed to sex at all. That this is their first introduction to the conversation.
Howard, is the sexual abuse of boys or young men different? In kind, we hear in quantity, maybe somewhat different. But are there other differences in the sort of patterns of abuse that you see of young men from young women, girls?
Yes, there are differences. For one, it has to do with the way that boys are socialized to learn about masculinity. You know, girls learn that they're supposed to be there for guys. Not that that's appropriate, but that's what they learn. Mm. Boys learn that they're supposed to be in power. They're not ever supposed to be victimized. Oftentimes in boys' victimization, there is more aggression, more violence. Not necessarily. It can be something very loving and caring from the perspective of the perpetrator. That's what they tell the boys who they're victimizing. There's a lot more shame that boys tend to harbor because of that violation of their masculinity, and so they tend to stay silent for much longer times.
Mikhail, do you see that? Is the ease? Do women really talk about this more easily, ultimately, than men? It can be shameful for both genders.
I think it's easier for women to talk about it, at least with one another, than it is for men. It is absolutely verboten, or it has been until mm-hmm. recently. I think the clergy abuse, the media, although the conversation stopped a little bit around clergy abuse, as if that was the only time that boys mm-hmm. had been violated like this. I mean, we're seeing this can happen with a coach, can happen with a clergy member, a nun, a teacher, a babysitter. But it happens to adults. It happens in the military. It happens to teenagers with a mentor, which makes it all the more confusing because it's not always in a violent context. It can be under the auspices of love or caring, which makes this all the more confusing.
And with lifetime consequences?
Absolutely. And not always conscious. People's reactions can create either being very shut down physically or even in their muscles or the opposite, being hyper-masculine, being male models.
Being naked in Cosmo.
In Cosmo, absolutely.
Maybe. He didn't make the connection, but maybe there's something there.
That's a very typical manifestation of sexual abuse is that males tend to believe that their only value is to become a sex object. I work with many men who are survivors who are sex addicts.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour after the new revelations by U.S. Senator Scott Brown about male sexual abuse and its consequences. Howard Fradkin joins us from Columbus, Ohio, a psychologist who has worked with more than 1,000 male and female abuse survivors. Mikhail Rao is with me in the studio, a therapist who's done the same. They're both affiliated with Male Survivor, a nonprofit that works with survivors of exactly this kind of experience. Howard, Mikhail, please stand by. We have joining us right now from Stillwater, Oklahoma, Jared Nofziger, a male sexual abuse survivor when he was a boy, right around the time that Scott Brown ran into it. He ran into it. He's worked through it in therapy and joins us now. Jared Nofziger, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What was it like for you when you began to think about talking about what had happened to you as a boy? How did you weigh just that act in your mind, Jared?
Well, you have to realize that I had spent 30 years doing everything I could not to think about this.
Yeah.
It was quite disturbing and confusing to me when about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And after having found some supportive people online at malesurvivor.org, I found the courage to seek some help.
What do you think brought this back to the forefront of your mind? Why could you suddenly not get it off your mind after, what, this was 20, 30 more years after it happened?
Fantastic question. I was completely baffled and not the least bit, I was pretty irritated about it. Two things. First, I had taken my children to summer camp for the very first time. And at mm-hmm. the time, my kids were 10 and 13. And this was involved with the Episcopal Church, and part of my abuse story surrounds the Episcopal Church. And I think that brought back a lot of trappings of the church, which brought back a lot of memories. And then the sheer fact that my children were coming into the age where I was abused. I didn't realize that until I got into therapy, and that was the very first question I asked, why now? And my therapist said, how old are your kids? And it just hit me like
and
a ton of bricks.
Bingo, there it is. Who were your abusers? How old were you when they came after you?
I was 8 when I was first abused, and they were two brothers who lived in my neighborhood. One was my age, and one was an older boy who was about 16 at the time. And like Senator Brown, like so many victims of sexual abuse, I was coming from a home life that I was starved for attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of took that attention wherever I could find it. The second phase of my abuse started approximately age 13 and was a youth group sponsor in the Episcopal Church that I attended. And like Mikhail said, my situation there was he came at me from a very loving standpoint, you know, someone that was filling a fatherly type role.
Sort of presented himself as a buddy or mentor.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Once you began to come to grips with this, and how old were you when you began to think about it and talk about it?
I was 42.
You talked about it, you said, with therapists. What about with other men? Have you been able to talk about it with other men? Have you had other men since you've begun to deal with it openly come to you and say, oh yeah, I've been there? Or is it something that you have not been able to talk about within, let's say, a friendship context now?
I now have I have quite a few friends who are also survivors that I've met, mainly online, because online mm-hmm. provides initially an anonymity that I think so many of us men need as we struggle with this. But since I have started recovery, I'm very open with it, and I have quite a number of male friends that we offer support to each other. Before that, I had told my wife almost 19 years ago, and then we didn't talk about it again for 17 years.
Wow. Wow. Jared Noska, please stand by in Stillwater. Howard Fradkin, another story, another angle on this, and about the same ages that Scott Brown talked about in his revelations. Is there the window that opens up, a vulnerability? Okay, here you are. You're now in the bullseye. And what is that?
Well, the vulnerability is that these men, Jared, Scott, and many others, need fathering. They need somebody to care for them, somebody to love them, and in many cases, those people aren't there. In fact, oftentimes they're being abused in their homes, or they're experiencing or witnessing abuse in their homes, and they're scared, they're vulnerable, they want children, need attention. They need someone who's going to look to them and help them grow up and be adult boys, which is what every boy wants, to feel grown up. And so they would turn to somebody like a camp counselor, like a church leader to help them and guide them. And unfortunately, those people who are perpetrators will then take advantage of that child, of that boy, of that teenager, and use the trust that they've bestowed with them and betray that trust.
Mikhail, I wonder about the way society responds to this when it does come out. Do people take it as seriously as they take the abuse of girls or young women, or do they think, you know, boys will be boys, boys are very sexualized creatures, it'll roll off there? You know, what's the reaction?
I think that you nailed it. I think that oftentimes people tend to normalize this, quote. And by the way, it's really important to not say that every time boys are just playing around or having fun with each other or it is not necessarily always sexual abuse, but there is a sexualization almost in the culture that sort of underwrites how it's supposed to be okay.
But surely since time immemorial, boys have, especially when they're, you know, becoming adolescents and there's a crazy kinds of experimentation, they can be rowdy creatures. Where does it go from just, you know, sort of boys discovering their sexuality to boys being abused?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think that there is a power differential that happens mm-hmm. in sexual abuse. There's usually someone who has more power, either because they're a mentor, they're being admired, that one person will take advantage of the other in a sexual way.
Howard, when the survivors of this come to you, do they always know whether they've been abused or not? Or are they thinking sometimes, you know, is this just what everybody does?
Oftentimes they don't know. Often many men come to therapy because they're having problems in relationships. They can't form a relationship. They can't combine sex and love, and they can't figure out why. Often I have people like who were abused by their teachers, for instance, and they think, oh, I was the lucky one. You know, the teacher picked me. And we have to go over, you know, if your own child was being abused by their teacher, would you think they were lucky? And, of course, they always say, absolutely not. That'd be terrible. That would be wrong. And I say, well, what about you? And then they see it.
Jared, was it clear to you? Did you know for sure that you'd been abused? Or did you ever think, oh, you know, horsing around?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, when I told my wife about this, I characterized it as a mistake that I had made in my past.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's just a lot of confusion with the abuse, and especially if the child had any type of sexual pleasure involved. And there's going to be a biological response anytime you're stimulated, and that was the case with me. And
so
there's a lot of confusion, and then when your abuser tells you that, see, it's clearly you wanted this because you enjoyed it.
Right.
And from a young age, you start believing, well, gee, I must have.
Do you still feel like it was your mistake, or have you come to see that differently, Jared?
Oh, not at all. You know, it took a lot of therapy. And like Mikhail said, I did a lot of minimization even as I entered therapy that, okay, this, when I did admit it, it did happen, but, you know, it's no big deal. You know, things happen. Guys need to get on with their lives. We need to suck it up and move on with our life, but that doesn't work that way. But no, I realize now it's not my fault at all.
Not always at all that easy. This is seldom talked about. It's talked about right now because of Senator Scott Brown's memoir. He may have political reasons to have a memoir. He may have all kinds of motivations, but it's put this issue in public. It was also in public last fall. Oprah Winfrey did a kind of a precedent-setting show about this. I'm going to play some tape from that in just half a minute here. And I want to say up front, this is more explicit, more rugged than you'll normally hear. It's already been on national television, and it's a big issue. It's a tough issue. But she spoke among the many men she spoke with who were survivors of sexual abuse as boys, as young men, was the actor and director Tyler Perry. He described a pretty rough history of sexual abuse, starting with an incident with a neighbor when he was 5 years old. We're going to play some of that tape. If you've got kids around, you may want to shoo them off. It's a little disturbing, but it's a fact of life for many American males, not just young women. Here's Tyler Perry on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
I'm building a birdhouse, and, you know, he had his hands in my pants.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, what is this? And I felt my body betraying me because I felt, it's odd because I felt an erection at that age.
At that age.
That's all I remember about him. And the next person I remember was a nurse in the hospital. I had been rushed to the emergency room from school for something, and a male nurse comes in, and he was doing the same thing that this man was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the person, the man in the church who, you know, used God.
Mm.
And the Bible against me, you know, mm-hmm. to justify a lot of the things that were going on. It was so horrible. And that was the first time. My first sexual experience was with this man performing oral sex on me as a boy.
A boy who starts out building a birdhouse. And soon, Mikhail, you've got this litany. I mean, it's hard to hear. It's hard to confront. But repeated instances of it in Tyler Perry's life. Who gets targeted? Is it anybody? Is it some special circumstance? You know, what makes some boys end up with that kind of really rough litany?
You know, I've given this a lot of thought, and sometimes people say sensitive boys are the ones that are targeted, but actually I think it could be any kid. You know, the kids that like to play baseball and the kids that are, you know, kind of squirrely and that, you know, just love to, you know, hang out and play with their buddies and whatever. It can be just about anybody, and that's probably why this is so disturbing. I think it's important to note, though, that this conversation brings, to me, just the fact that we're talking about it. The fact that people who have stored this in their bodies and their muscle tissue for all these years, just the fact that it's being talked about and not held secret, not held over with shame, is giving men maybe an opening to talk about something that has happened, because that's the first step. That's, you know, sort of the three noble truths of sexual abuse. You know, yes, it happens more than we'd like to think, but there's support, and you're not alone. And I think it's important that people know that.
Talking about it right now, it puts it out there, may give people permission to say no, certainly permission to talk about what has happened in their own personal histories and maybe get beyond it. Mikhail Howard, Jared, please stand by. I want to bring our listeners in. Marty, calling from Woburn, Massachusetts. Marty, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be on the air.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a 59-year-old survivor. My abuse took place when I was 19. And before I mention that, I just wanted to say that 40 years later, with treatment and with a lot of support, I still deal with sort of what's referred to as post-traumatic stress, in which any kind of thing could trigger me off to feel upset, basically. And what was interesting, I spent 2 days Thursday and Friday after hearing about Scott, you know, feeling really sad, and to the point that people noticed it. And it was a sense of grief.
Sad because it brought your experience back, or because it made you think, oh my gosh, this happens to so many people?
I think my own experience allowed me to sort of identify with the pain that this man has gone through in coming forward with his process. And so for me, it was just like, actually, it was a good experience that I was feeling grief for him, not for myself.
Yeah. And when you say post-traumatic stress and how it comes out, is it anger? Is it alienation, loneliness? What for you, Marty?
Oh, it changes over time. I was first aware of the problem 20 years afterwards when one of my colleagues said to me, how come you're so intent on getting these kids services? I was in human services. Mm-hmm. I go, well, they've been abused.
Mm-hmm.
And it was particularly realizing that some of these boys that were in our program, you know, the rumors were about abuse. And so I was like getting them to therapists and everything. And they noticed my hypervigilance about it. And so just being around kids that there was a suspicion about, at that point, unconsciously set me off to become hypervigilant about them and hyperprotective. And so, you know, I started talking to therapists, and finally one of them yanked it out of me.
Mm-hmm.
He had to go through a list. And what he came to was a priest that I had gone to back in the days of the draft for a draft letter.
Wow.
And he wove a very careful and intricate story that in order to get this letter from him, I would need to prove myself. And he would test me morally.
Yeah.
And it turned into a physical assault, sexual assault, sacramental issues, as well as psychological belittlement.
Incredible.
Because when I finally stopped it, he said, well, I knew you couldn't take it. And then that was just all closeted for decades.
Marty, we're up against a clock here, but I appreciate your call, and I wish you luck with that. Jared Nofziger, when you hear others put their stories on the table, what are you thinking? Are you thinking of this, the scale of this problem? Are you thinking of the personal trial involved in coming to grips with it?
Both of those things, and I think, like Marty, it changes over time, but it's certainly easy to get completely bogged down in the scale. Early on in my recovery, it was difficult to go to my son's Little League game because I would be looking at the other children, the other boys, saying, which ones? How can I help them? How can I stop this? I think I have a little bit more mature perspective about it now, and doing things like speaking to you today is a way that I can have an impact on that.
Jared Nofziger, in Stillwater, Oklahoma, we appreciate the courage it's taken for you to come to that point and the personal work that that must have required. We're grateful to you for sharing your story with us today. We wish you and a whole lot of kids out there good luck. Thank you very much for being with us, Jared.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking after the new revelations by U.S. Senator Scott Brown about male sexual abuse and its consequences. Mikhail Rao is with us. Trauma therapist, has worked with a lot of survivors of this kind of abuse. So has Howard Fradkin, joining us from Columbus, Ohio, both with the Male Survivor, malesurvivor.org, Male Survivor, a nonprofit that looks at and helps men who have gone through this. A little more right here from Tyler Perry. We heard him. He was on Oprah talking about this. But what it was like to live with this in the aftermath, even to look back on his childhood, because it was so woven with this abuse.
For me, a living hell. You know, I was able to, somewhere along the way, my saving grace was I learned how to leave myself. I remember my mother and my aunt taking me to the park. It's hard for me to look at those pictures because I feel like I died as a child.
I feel like I died as a child. Scott Brown on 60 Minutes last night saying, compared to what happened there, A lot of other things look like a piece of cake.
When I'm getting kind of the crap beat out of me outside in the political spectrum, I'm like, this is nothing. Bring it. Let's go. Next.
Let's go next. But it's not that easy to get around necessarily. Jason in Boston. Jason, thank you for calling. What's your story, Jason?
Hi, Tom. It's hard for me to talk about this.
Yeah.
I talk about this with a few of my very close male friends, but I don't know anybody who's a man who this has happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
When I was about 8 or 9, we moved, and I was abused by two teenage female neighbors.
How old were you, Jason?
I was about 8 or 9. So I really had no idea what was going on. I was just afraid and ashamed.
How old were they, Jason, if I may ask?
They were teenagers.
Okay.
Probably, I don't know, 13, 14 maybe.
So what were they doing? They sort of turned you into their toy? You were so young. You were ignorant, presumably. I mean, they just... Was it violent? Did they just sort of lure and toy you into it?
No, that you really put your finger on it. I was like their toy. It was a power thing, I think. They would threaten me with things like, you know, if you don't do this, we won't play with you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or
how did you finally get out of it?
There was kind of a big blowout, and my parents found out, and my father confronted their father, and I don't know what happened after that, but it was over after that. But
and what about the consequence?
They were very vengeful. I mean, even after that, they were still kind of being violent towards me. So whatever happened, I don't know. But
how would you describe the consequences of it in your life, Jason?
Well, like Jared described, you know, years, just not thinking about it. I minimized it for years, and it affected every aspect of my relationship with women. It robbed me of my any teenage sexual experience I had was marred and tainted by this fear and shame, all the way up into my young adulthood when I finally started getting therapy, and I'm in my mid-30s now, mm-hmm. and I would say I feel like I've finally come to a point where, you know, maybe just 4 or 5 years ago, where I could say, you know what, I'm not willing to let this be a big deal in my life anymore, and I just let it go. But that was after years of therapy and just reading and kind of hard work, journal writing, but it robbed me of some important experiences in my childhood, in my youth as a teenager and a young adult.
No doubt. Jason, I appreciate you putting that out there. We hope others will hear it and feel the freedom to describe what happened and confront it and maybe go beyond it. We'll talk about that, about living and thriving on the other side of that. I appreciate your call, Jason. One more right here from Brian in Boston. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What's your story?
Well, it's interesting to listen to other men talk about it. I'm someone that hasn't really spoken about it to too many people. I did do a few years of therapy, but interesting to hear. It was similar with me. I didn't really think about it until I hit into my 40s. And to me, it was a little different. It was actually an adult woman, a friend of my mother's.
How old were you, Brian?
I remember it probably starting at about 8 or 9 years old and continued right up until I was just an early teenager.
Did you feel trapped at the time? What was the leverage? What were the dynamics?
I think when you're 8 years old, you don't understand any of the dynamics. It starts with just a little bit of touching. And the interesting thing is when I listen in, as you become a young teenager and you're discovering, you know, the sexuality, you know, there was almost a sense of, I can remember a sense of, like, almost a sense of pride that I had accomplished something.
Yeah.
That my other friends hadn't. And even though it was a deep secret and I never told anybody.
And what about consequences in your life, Brian?
Obviously, you know, as everyone else talks about, there's an intimacy issue and trying to sustain relationships, and it is difficult. I mean, there is that sense of shame, and it comes up in certain times when you don't expect it.
Brian, I appreciate your stepping up so much to articulate that, and again, hope that it will help others who hear it and understand that they're not alone in this. Thank you so much, Brian. Mikhail Howard, 8 or 9 years old and kind of set on by teenage women or older women than that, a friend of the mother that seems so young, Howard, to be targeted.
It does seem young, and obviously adult women and teenage girls do choose these kinds of vulnerable boys to victimize. You know, one of the things that I talk about with men regarding minimization is that I tell them that sexual abuse doesn't happen. We always ask that question, when did it happen? And I tell people that tornadoes happen, hurricanes happen. Sexual abuse is a choice that people in power, people who are bigger, stronger, older, choose to do to a victim, to a vulnerable boy. And it's really important that we think about that instead of it happening.
Mikhail, we're getting real stories here, but there's a lot of, I would guess, mythology kind of woven around these circumstances. Are there myths that victims of this face when they try to sort of understand what happened with them?
Yes, and that's why they don't come forward, because a lot of survivors feel that if I'm a survivor, that means I will, it's an automatic thing that I probably... maybe I would be a perpetrator.
So they feel like they may incriminate themselves. People will shun them.
It would just happen automatically.
Cycle on.
And that is not true. Mm-hmm. They feel that they're permanently damaged. They feel like they can never get this thing off their back, out of their skin, out of their muscles.
They don't want to feel like damaged goods.
A lot of men feel a sexual confusion that is very confounding to them. They may, whether they're straight men that wonder if they're gay or gay men that wonder what, it is as if sexual orientation has anything to do with this.
Let's stick with that for a second. You're saying, I mean, the stories we're hearing today, you could see angles of them as homosexual, but then others, not at all, clearly women involved or other boys where I'm not sure what's going on in terms of that kind of categories of sexuality.
That's right. It's very complicated. It's not just one thing or another. We can't just globalize this situation. And
Howard, are men afraid of being seen as homosexual, if that's a fear factor for them, if they bring up this kind of abuse?
Absolutely. If a boy is gay or is going to become gay and he's perpetrated by a male, then he feels like they figured him out. And so there's a lot of shame about that. If they're going to be straight and they're perpetrated by a male, they freak out because then they think they are going to become gay or that the abuse has made them gay. That's not true. The other thing I like to tell people is that abuse is not sex. You know, when Tyler Perry, you were sharing his story.
He said his body betrayed him because it responded to the circumstances.
Right. And that's one of the differences between boys and girls is that boys have this obvious sign. You know, mm-hmm. they have a penis that gets erect, mm-hmm. and girls don't have that. And so perpetrators use that erection to prove to their
complicity
victim.
Complicity or something, they suggest.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They're complicit, that they enjoyed it, that they must have wanted it. And that makes it very confusing.
Wow. We've got so many responses to this. Jim says online, he's a survivor, he says, let's be clear, these acts don't just happen. Rain happens, snow happens, sexual abuse is committed against children who are not in a position to understand or consent, and it's committed against boys as well as girls. He says, let's keep talking about this. Benhar, another online, says, what I don't understand is how Senator Brown could now walk away from identifying a dangerous abuser who is still out there. He could protect other vulnerable children but chooses not to. That is, Scott Brown has said he's not interested in pursuing legal prosecution, even if the law would allow in this case. What do you think of that, Mikhail? Is that reasonable at this point?
I think it's a common response. People are thinking that it just happened to them. I mean, my suspicion is whatever happened to Senator Brown happened to other boys?
Let's go to John in Spring Hill, Tennessee. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
All right. What's your story, John?
Tom, I just kind of got in this in the middle of it, and I've heard some stories, and it relates a lot to me. My heart's probably beating about 200 miles a minute, and it's happened. I'm in my late 40s, and it happened to me when I was about 10 years old, and it started with a teenage girl about 17 and then progressed from 10 to 15 with a number of people, adults included, men included. And, you know, you talk about consequences, and I haven't heard it mentioned, but I am one that fights addiction over this.
What kind of addiction, John?
A sexual addiction. So I was, most of my life, not being able to separate. You know, I couldn't connect intimacy and sexual relations together. It was either or, and pretty much acted out constantly with people where I didn't have to get close to them. And it was mostly, you know, after going to counseling, you know, at 33, at the verge of, you know, wanting to end my life.
Yeah.
Because I didn't feel normal.
Yeah.
And then a counselor just, you know, finally got it out of me that I had been abused as a child, that, you know, it was, you know, it wasn't my fault. And, you know, at that point, starting to heal, it's been a lifelong journey for me, because it's a very difficult thing with me.
Multiple kinds of abuse during those years, and a sexual addiction lingering after that. John, we wish you good luck with all of it. It sounds like you are confronting it, and I appreciate that, and you're sharing that with us. Thanks for calling, John. Howard, Mikhail, what about addiction on the other side? Or what about, if we can just kind of run through potential consequences here so that listeners can think about the list, and if they're having these, sort of recognize the possible relationship here. Howard?
Sexual addiction is a very common form of after effect. 80% of sex addicts have been either sexually abused, physically or emotionally abused, or severely neglected. So sexual abuse is a high category of problems that people have. Other kinds of addiction, chemical dependency, alcoholism is very common because men are trying to numb themselves out so they don't have to feel anything. Gambling addictions, online, internet addiction, lots of trouble with intimacy, trouble with starting relationships, problems staying in relationships, problems with sexual orientation confusion, as we've mentioned. Problems with sexual functioning and dysfunction are very common.
Mikhail, are you thinking of others in that list?
I am. I'm thinking about rage and anger. I'm also thinking about numbness. A lot of men and women go through life completely shut down.
Emotional
shutdown, physical shutdown, and they don't make the link to what's happened to them in their past. They just figure this is the way life is. It's always in a little gray. There's no rainbow effect in their lives.
Since the many stories within the Catholic Church came out, this has been widely tied to the church. But when I look at what I'm seeing here, this is much bigger. That's one bucket within a much bigger picture.
That's right. It can happen, as I said. It can happen anywhere. I'm remembering Howard say happen. So sexual abuse and exploitation, I mean, even in a cultural way, because there's so much sexualized material in our culture that it makes it more conducive to the atmosphere just always opening to that. And I think that a lot of children and older children experimenting or who are reenacting some of the experiences they've had with somebody else, this happens. This is why it might happen with an older boy, with a younger boy. They can't always metabolize what has happened to them.
Howard, speak to us, first of all, our time grows short, but about, you know, how can we be vigilant against this? How can we try and tilt society to minimize this? It'll never go away entirely. And then we've just got a minute, but what about hope for those who have been through this, hope for living and thriving on the other side?
Well, I want all survivors who are hearing this, men and women, to hear that healing is absolutely possible and achievable. We invite you to dare to dream that you can survive, you can recover, you can reclaim your life and everything that was taken from you. There's lots of support out there. MaleSurvivor.org, 1in6.org, RAIN.org. There are a number of websites that are available to help men. Parents, I advise you to talk to your children and tell them it's always okay to come and tell you anytime there's a problem, no matter what it is. You'll never punish them for coming to you if they have a problem, if they're concerned, if they're upset about somebody touching them or hurting them. Children need lots of permission to talk, and as soon as they find out they can't, then they don't. And that's why so many people keep quiet. So we really need to encourage people to have the freedom to talk.
Permission to speak. Mikhail, do you think we're getting into a zone of greater permission here as these become topics of public conversation?
I certainly hope so. I think just having a program like this gives us all permission to speak more openly about what happens in our society, in our families, behind closed doors, in churches, in synagogues, in camps.
Life.
Yeah. In life, yes.
There's so much we confront. We hope we're healthier when we speak of it, when we put it out there and put it out there with compassion and empathy. And as Howard says, hope. Howard Fradkin in Columbus, Ohio, thank you so much for being with us today.
My honor, Tom.
And Mikhail Rao, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.